Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to talk about religion, politics, and morality with people whose perspective differs from yours? And are those conversations best avoided in polite company, or are they requirements for any dynamic, intelligent society? Rabbi Brad Hirschfield is here to talk about how he handles such situations, and he handles them often. He's a radio and television host, he's a print and internet columnist, and president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. His latest book is called You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism. He's in town for the Jewish Community Center of Dallas's annual book fair, where he is scheduled to speak tonight at 7 o'clock. Rabbi, welcome to Think.
Good to be here, Chris. Thanks for having me.
You wrote recently that you were as concerned about how we would all come together on November 5th as you were about whatever was going to happen on November 4th.
Right. I mean, I think in many ways that's the real challenge, because elections will come and go. But we're here as a country in between those elections. And how we treat each other and how we deal with whoever's in power is really not so simple, especially when you have an election that was so incredibly polarized. I mean, it's interesting. We have an election in which there's really a landslide in terms of electoral votes, but not a landslide in terms of the popular vote, right? So you can look at those landslide numbers on the Electoral College and think, wow, the whole country is going in this direction. But that's not correct, right? Only 8 million people of the 124 million who casted votes, that's the whole divide between Obama and McCain. And so really, how we are going to be one country moving forward, given that only 8 million of us, about 6%, was the spread between the winner and the loser, is really critical, especially when you have winners who were so animated, and I say this in a good way, by incredible hopes and remarkable aspirations. The truth is, maybe more hope and aspiration than anyone, even the current president-elect, could ever possibly deliver. So both how we move forward, given the fact there was such excitement, and also what the group that's most excited will do if, in fact, every hope and aspiration isn't realized in the first 30 days of the new presidency.
Yeah, it's amazing how fast we expect results now. Even, you know, you can look at history and it doesn't happen that fast.
No, it doesn't. Look, big changes take time, right? It takes time for things to get bad. It usually takes twice as much time for things to get better. And again, I'm not judging which was bad, which was better, but just in general, patience is really critical. And it's hard because oftentimes the incredible hope and aspiration that allows positive change to occur brings with it, and it's a good thing, incredible enthusiasm. And if you're like me, that enthusiasm often breeds impatience. And it feels so good to be impatient because we're impatient for something wonderful. On the other hand, it gives a kind of frustration that can turn into cynicism when you don't get exactly what you want. And I think one of the things that the victorious side in this election is really going to have to be on guard against is a kind of a quick onset of cynicism when everything that we hoped would happen doesn't happen too quickly.
Well, you know, it's very interesting because President-elect Obama, when he gave his speech, said, to those who did not vote for me, who do not support me, I am your president, too. I want to listen. And a lot of people who like Obama heard that and were delighted to hear it. But when George W. Bush came into office, he was seen as a sort of bipartisan leader. And most of the presidents before then have said, now that I've won, I am the president for everyone. And unfortunately, politics in this country, as opposed to being sort of arguing to find a solution, it seems many times that one party or the other will fight to win.
No, I think that's right. And I appreciate the desire to fight to win, right? If you have ideas, you should definitely fight to win. But if you confuse winning the election with winning for the nation, whatever party you represent, you're doing it wrong, right? The reason you want to win an election, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, is to serve the entire nation. Does Obama mean it? I hope so. Has every president said it? Yes. Have they all performed equally well? No. But I do think there are kind of guidelines that both sides can observe that will help whatever we think of the president-elect actually make it a victory for the country. I think for the people who supported Obama, there's got to be a real caution against kind of triumphalism, that sense of, you know, we won and now we're going to make up for 8 terrible years and we are the children of light and you were the children of darkness. Now everything is going to be great because we're in charge. However much any of us may feel that, I can't think of a time in history when that attitude toward governance actually worked out well for anybody. On the other hand, the side that lost has to really guard against bitterness. Right? No one should be defined by a loss in a single election. So the real challenge for people on the right is going to be to say, okay, we lost. We have to learn from that loss. And more importantly, we have to figure out how we're going to work with the victors, because our ability to contribute to political discourse in this country and to the making of good public policy is not over. We lost an election. We didn't lose the country.
I wonder if the two-party system is part of the problem in terms of people needing to define themselves. Granted, most elections in recent history have been decided by the people who live in the middle, who go from one person to the next. But there are still sort of polarizing elements.
Look, any time you have a binary system, you have two major parties, the chance is of falling into the either-or kind of game, and that's never too good. On the other hand, as I look at parliamentary systems around the world and having spent significant time in Israel, I'm reminded of the Winston Churchill quote, right? We are the absolute worst system in the world, except for all the others. There's a kind of paralysis and small-mindedness that it seems to me parliamentary multi-party systems rewards. It's amazing how much leverage you can get being a single issue party. I know this most intimately in Israel, but we see it around the world. We see it in England. We see it actually less so in France, which has got a system in terms of parties that's closer to our own, somewhere in between. So I think with each model, you have certain advantages and certain real disadvantages. The more than two-party system, you end up with some insane ideas because, you can always find a few people who will support that one view, and all of a sudden you're a power broker, which is not so helpful. It kind of rewards narrow thinking. The problem with a two-party system is that you're right. It does divide us between these two groups by and large and creates a sense of you're with us or you're against us. And that's why, again, I think the single biggest challenge is, you can feel you're with us or you're against us in a particular election. What neither side can ever do and must never do is talk about being with us or against us after the election. After the election, there's only one us. That is what I think President-elect Obama means when he talks about being the United States of America. Not red states and not blue states. That's fine for during the election. But the morning after, there's one us.
Why do you think it is that we focus so much on the things we disagree on? There are a few core issues that in another context might not be the most important issues for a lot of people, but we choose those to decide which side of the color spectrum we fall on.
No, I think you're right. And I think it's because, by and large, we often define ourselves based on who we're not, mm-hmm. as opposed to what we most love. And it's a funny thing that we do it, and there are reasons I think that go all the way back to the earliest roots of the Western intellectual tradition, going back to Socrates and Aristotle and Plato, this notion that truth is the byproduct of falsifying everything else. So in order to be a good Democrat, I don't actually need to know much about Democratic Party platform or its values. I just need to know that Republicans are mean-spirited medievals. And in order to be a good Republican, I actually don't need to know much about conservative political theory or its implications for the country. I just need to know that Democrats are a bunch of weak-willed, non-caring, postmodern, paralyzed idiots. And as long as I know that, then I must be doing right by my party. And so I think what we're going to have to figure out, and it's always the key to talking about the political and religious issues, which I don't think should be ignored, right? That old adage about the two things you should never talk about in public being religion and politics is only because we care so much and haven't yet evolved enough to know how to talk about it well. So I don't think ignoring problems doesn't usually make them better, right? You have to develop the tools. And so I think that's what's going to happen when we start to realize you don't know who you are because of who you aren't. You know who you are because you actually love being who you are. And the best example I can give on a much more basic level, but sometimes it's helpful, is if you're lucky enough to wake up every morning next to someone you love, can you imagine turning to them and saying, honey, the reason we're together is not because you're wise or beautiful or kind, but everyone else is so damn stupid, ugly, and mean that I think I'll stick with you. Now, I don't know about you, but I know where I wouldn't be sleeping if that's how I treated my wife. So really what we have to do is learn to fall in love again with whatever beliefs we hold most dear. And my experience is when you're deeply in love, even the people out there who you don't think are so perfect, they look kind of beautiful to you.
Rabbi Brad Hirschfield is my guest. He's in town to speak this evening at 7 to the Jewish Community Center of Dallas. They're holding their annual book fair. He's the author of a book most recently called You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, is 1-800-933-5372. So let's talk about the way people speak about political issues that they hold dear with people they hold dear in their lives who don't necessarily agree. In my family, occasionally what will happen is there's this sort of volley of vitriolic emails that goes from the left side of the family to the right.
You must be related to me.
Yeah. And everybody sort of feels like they're going to send the email that really absolutely skewers the other side to the other side. And it seems like that salvo ends up with nothing except, you know, an upended turkey plate on Thanksgiving.
Right. Look, I think there are a couple things. There's an emotional side to this, and there's kind of a how do we manage these family dynamics when we're sending those incredible emails. And I have that in my own family. There are some people who recently met and talked politics with my parents and wrote me an email and said, were you adopted? It was that jarring to them. And in a more serious way, getting an email from one of my mom's oldest friends saying, what do I do? I love your mother, and I'm terrified when she talks politics. And this is the psychological piece. I said, look, you've identified exactly the right emotion. It's fear. And it's on the right and it's on the left. We get afraid of each other because we imagine that how can I love someone who thinks so differently than me? As opposed to saying, wow, this is going to be a moment when we find out how much I love you. Because we're going to have to admit, not only do we not agree, we're probably never going to agree and still discover that we love each other. Right? And that's actually not so hard once we stop pretending that love is a function of agreement. It's not a function of agreement. It's about something much bigger. How do you do that practically? It's simple. If every time we get ready to send one of those emails that's, you know, going to show them the light, we, instead of sending that email, sent a question first saying, can you explain to me what most concerns you about the people and ideas I support? And if each side actually did that, we would begin to learn from each other, not to convince each other, not to show each other the light, because that doesn't work that way, but simply to learn about each other. And then all of a sudden, holding different views isn't as scary. I mean, I know in my own life, whether it's about politics or religion here in the States or abroad, or actually with my own mother. You really can't
Which
be someone...
Which transcends both politics and religion.
Oh, like you wouldn't believe. Actually, that stuff's talked about in the book, so it's totally... It's literally an open book for the world to read. You really can't be someone else's teacher until you're willing to become their student. And so I think the more powerfully you want to advocate for a particular cause, the more committed you have to be to learning precisely from those people who don't share your views.
There's a risk there, though, when you open yourself up.
There is a risk. But in the end, if you really believe in your ideas... That's what great ideas are supposed to do. They're supposed to give us the strength to take risk. Whether it's a great political idea or a profound spiritual tradition, they're not meant to be blankets that insulate us from the reality of life. They really are meant to be like battery packs that get us recharged so we can open ourselves up and take all those risks.
Rabbi Brad Hirschfield is my guest. He's in town to speak tonight at the Jewish Community Center of Dallas. That event starts at 7. You can find information about it at jccdallas.org. His latest book is called You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism. We'll be back to our discussion in a moment. And if you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Rabbi Brad Hirschfield is in town to speak to the Jewish Community Center of Dallas tonight at 7 for their annual book fair and was kind enough to schedule his plane a little early to come in and speak with us. His latest book is called You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism. We're talking to him today about talking about faith and also about political values and sort of national values. We'd love for you to join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Was it troublesome to you that there was a lot of effort to explain to voters before the election the correct information that Barack Obama was a Christian and not a Muslim, but that almost nobody addressed out loud the fact that if a certain candidate, Obama or anyone else, had been a Muslim, that that still wouldn't have been a reasonable excuse for excluding him from consideration?
It's incredibly disturbing. I mean, I think
nobody talked about this.
The only person who took it on really in any national way was Colin Powell on Meet the Press, right? Who began to explain that, of course, Barack Obama is not a Muslim, and I mean, it's bizarre that we're even still talking about that. But of course, there's a lot of fear there, and so the campaign did the only thing it could do, which was try and diffuse that fear with fact. One of the lessons, by the way, I think we can learn about across the board, when people are driven by fear, you can give them all the facts in the world, it probably won't help. Because the fear that we experience is almost a pre-intellectual kind of thing. And what we'd have to really do is not so much keep saying, he's a Christian, he's a Christian, he's a Christian, don't worry, don't worry, don't worry, but actually say to people, what are you most afraid of about the idea of a Muslim president? So there is a kind of unfortunate reality here in which neither was addressed. The genuine fears weren't addressed, nor was the genuine racism that animates a piece of those fears. So when Colin Powell comes on TV and says, look, of course he's a Christian, but it shouldn't matter, and gave us that image of a 7-year-old Muslim boy imagining that he could be president and that that was the greatness of America, and if that dream is taken away, something is profoundly wrong with our public culture. And of course he was correct. But without addressing those fears, I don't think we're going to make the shift. And so this is really complicated. On the one hand, it ought to be completely irrelevant if the president of the United States is Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, secular, atheist, agnostic, or Muslim. On the other hand, those of us who believe that most dearly and deeply have got to dignify the partial truth that people have of the fear of a Muslim president, by saying there may be a challenge in terms of a certain segment of global Islam. But in the same way that you're not afraid of having a Christian become president, even though there are some Christians who blow up hospitals because they perform abortions, do you really want to say no to every Muslim because there are some Muslims who fly planes into buildings? In other words, you've got to take the fear seriously. Just telling someone, oh, don't be afraid, does that ever work? It doesn't. And so ironically, it seems to me the only way to transcend the racism behind the fear of him being a Muslim is to acknowledge the partial truth of the fear, and from that partial truth create the moral authority to say, okay, we're going to deal with what you're most afraid of in order to get to the other side, in which actually it shouldn't matter at all.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Campbell in Fort Worth. Hey, Campbell.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
My question is I had an opportunity to be in Israel during the election, and when Obama was announced that he had won the election, the people there were just elated over it. And my question is why is the people of Israel, why were they so impacted by this election?
Well, it's people in Israel and all over the world in many cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think around the world people were excited because, frankly, a lot of people didn't think this was possible. They just assumed a black guy is going to become president of the United States? No, that'll never happen. By the way, at the risk of sounding overly patriotic, all those countries in which they assumed America could never do that, I'm curious, have they elected any people of color or any minorities? I think one of the stories behind this is not that it's so unlikely it would have happened in America. Frankly, it's that of all the places in the world where it was most likely to happen was here in America. And that some of the excitement around the world, oh, look what the Americans finally did, is a way of deflecting from it ever happening in their country and their own discomfort. I mean, France still wants to outlaw a lot of public expression of Islam, let alone elect an African-American, an African-Russian, African-French person with a name, middle name of Hussein. I mean, so of course it's easy to say, oh yes, the Americans finally did that. It'd be interesting to see what will happen if we get a black prime minister in England or a black prime minister in France. So I think that's a whole separate piece of the story. I think in Israel, actually, the polling showed about one-third of the population didn't really care. They assumed that whoever was elected president of the United States understood that the relationship between the State of Israel and the United States is good not just for Israel but important for the security interests of the United States, and so it didn't matter who was elected. About one-third, not surprisingly, more on the right, more represented by Israel's more right-wing parties, were in favor of John McCain. And about one-third, not surprisingly, those from the center, more to the left, were entirely excited about Barack Obama being elected. What I think it does prove is that the people who were questioning whether or not the Israel-American relationship would be as sacred in an Obama administration as it was to a McCain administration, there was no question about it. And you could ask people either right here, or you can ask people in Israel. That was never an issue.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Rabbi Brad Hirschfield. You can see him tonight at the Jewish Community Center of Dallas's book fair. He will be speaking at 7. You can also read his book. It's called You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Fighting Faith Without Fanaticism. Let's speak next to Terrence in Rockwall. Hi, Terrence.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
That's good. Well, I had a comment. I was just listening, and when he was describing how to win arguments, and that's the category I was put in, by dignifying the response so it allows you to get the moral authority. I just thought that was a beautiful way of describing how that can be done, because so many times when people, I find, are trying to have conversations with others that they disagree with, they just don't allow themselves to listen to what the other person is saying so that they can gain that moral authority. And I find that just by listening to others, you do get that moral authority, because you're allowing yourself to listen and you're actually able to respond line by line to what they said, as opposed to just generalizing and don't be afraid, as he was saying about the Obama thing, like, oh, don't be afraid, you know, he's not Muslim, but actually not asking the question, well, what's your fear about actually having a Muslim president? Like, people don't ever get that chance to win those arguments, and that's why they always leave, you know, just like little fifth graders, just like slapping at each other rather than actually having, you know, a discussion that's productive. And I just want to know, want him to expand more on that moral authority and how we actually gain that in debates that we have with others.
Yeah, thanks for your call.
I think it's a great, great point, Terrence. I guess what you have to do, and you've really just described it, the willingness to listen before we start talking is actually strategically and tactically valuable. It's not just educationally and philosophically and psychologically appropriate. The truth is, when you hear someone first, by and large, especially in a culture with so little listening, whether they want to or not, they're going to listen to you more. They simply will. And so I think that in any situation, if you could actually go in assuming your first job is to listen carefully before it is to proclaim anything, at the back end, you'll be able to do more proclaiming than you ever imagined. But if you walk into the room with a set speech that you're going to give no matter what, it is highly unlikely that anyone who already doesn't agree with you will be able to hear what you're saying. And if they already agree with you, you should go home and listen to the radio as opposed to giving the speech, because no one's learning anything new.
Is Obama's election automatically, do you think, a game changer in terms of the way we talk about bigotry and prejudice in this country, or do we still need to make a really concerted effort to ensure that we sort of steer those conversations in a positive direction?
Yes. Yeah. I think it's both, and I have both great expectations and some reservations. The mere fact of his election is historic, and you would have to have an awfully hard heart, whatever your politics are, not to be moved by the idea that we still have in this country people who are the grandchildren of slaves who lived to see an African American become the president of this country. I don't care if you disagree with 100% of the things he will do as president. This is a kind of collective redemption, the scale of which I really believe no other country has ever pulled off. And so ironically, some of the most conservative and patriotic in that way elements of the country should be the most proud about this. And it does close the door on a whole chapter of our history. I do think it redefines what it means to be, you know, a minority in this country, and particularly a black person in this country. What concerns me, frankly, is that the moment he was elected, there were people the next morning, Michael Eric Dyson spoke and other leaders in the African-American community, that, you know, this is still a very racist country. 12 hours after he stood in Grant Park, and I was there, and spoke about what this means, 12 hours later, this is still a racist country? That does concern me. And it concerns me anytime any minority, be it Jews or blacks or Muslims or anyone, need to perpetuate their class or their status as victims in order to have a clearly defined sense of who they are. It seems to me now the challenge is we have turned a corner. And everyone needs to begin to ask, what will it mean in this country when victim status for 10% of our nation is no longer a viable way of figuring out who they are and who they want to be?
Is this a conversation that you have often, or a discussion or an argument that you have often within the Jewish community specifically?
It's a great concern to me. I mean, it's funny. I was just talking about this with someone. There's a new film out called The Boy in the Striped Pajamas. And I haven't seen the movie, but it's a great book. I love this book. And the book is the story of a 7-year-old boy whose father is the commandant of a death camp, which he can't quite pronounce because he's a little kid, and he calls it Outwith, and presumably it's Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. And especially this week, you know, today is Kristallnacht 70 years ago. And a lot of Jewish reviewers aren't comfortable about this movie. In the story, little Bruno befriends one of the children in striped pajamas who live in his backyard just beyond the fence. And it's an amazing story of the relationship between the child of the commandant and this little boy in striped pajamas named Shmuel. And it has an incredibly tragic and ironic ending that I will not spoil for people, but is a wonderful metaphor about the ways in which any time our solution of a better world hinges on getting rid of other people, we all suffer in profound ways. But I have watched as Jewish reviewers are deeply uncomfortable about a story which evokes such profound sympathy for this little German boy. And of course, it strikes me as so odd because, of course, the way any event becomes important to all people is when it becomes a part of all people's story. If the Holocaust is just the story of Jewish suffering, then eventually it will be forgotten, even by Jews. But if it becomes a model for understanding how destructive it is to create a picture of a better world that hinges on destroying other human beings, that we're all going to suffer, every person on this planet will need and want to know that story in order to create a world in which it never happens to anybody. Now, I know that means Jews surrendering a part of our unique status as the ultimate sufferers in that war. And I want to be clear, the Holocaust was primarily directed against Jews. But Jews were not its only victims. And it seems to me if we want the story to be relevant in 50 years or in 500 years, it needs to belong to all people. It needs to be a story of how hate of any group ultimately destroys every group.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email us this afternoon. That goes to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Ron in Plano. Hello, Ron.
Ron?
Hi, Ron.
Yes, I wanted to ask your guest if he believes in the idea of separation of church and state as a vehicle, if you will, to kind of protect various religious members of the country so that you don't end up with one religion, you know, being dominant. For instance, there are still several countries who use Islamic scriptures as a mechanism to define rules that, in some cases, at least in Western perception, might reduce the civil rights of women, etc. And I'm not saying that's across the board because I know plenty of Muslims that do not take that to that extreme, but there again, to me, separation of church and state seems to control those kinds of conflicts.
Thanks for your call.
I believe deeply that separation of church and state is a sacred principle. I'm choosing those words purposefully. There is no question in my mind that the separation of religion and state and religious authorities making public policy has got to be not only a separation, but one guaranteed by a significant wall. On the other hand, I believe that religious wisdom can inform the public's thinking about the future of public policy and of the future of the country. In other words, I don't think religion should have any power to determine anything for anyone in the American public square. But I do believe that people animated by religious ideas should be players in that public square. And I think that that's the difference between saying leave all religion out or allow religion to dictate the lives of others. The third possibility is, like in any other area, bring all of who you are and all of what you believe most dearly to a public conversation about where we should all end up. And then know, the more power that your ideas have, the more obligated you are to make sure that those who don't agree with you are always protected. And that's not my idea, and it's not a particular religion's idea. Tocqueville saw it when he came to America and understood the danger of the tyranny of majority. So we believe in majority rule, but part of what comes with majority rule is majority's obligation to protect minorities, whether they're religious, ethnic, or economic. That's one of the obligations that comes with the blessing of real majority rule.
I think it might have been in one of your columns that I read that the one thing that the majority of Americans can agree on with regard to someone that they would elect is that they do not want an atheist. Someone who was avowed as an atheist is something that the majority of Americans say they're more uncomfortable with than someone of a vastly different faith than their own.
Yeah, it's true. Look, we are a very religious country. In fact, somewhere around 90%+ of us believe in some kind of higher power. And that's a pretty interesting kind of thing to deal with. That means that the religious among us better figure out how to dignify that 10% or so who don't, because that's another version. Whatever your belief is, if it doesn't include fighting for the beliefs of others, it's ultimately going to bear bitter fruit, both for you and for them. So again, the first obligation of any passionate belief, political, religious, or otherwise, is try and make sure you can hear the voices of and learn from people who don't share your views.
Rabbi Brad Hirschfield is here. His latest book is called You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism. We'll be back in just a moment. You can send email to think@kera.org, or there is one line open at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to Think on KERA 90.1, I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Rabbi Brad Hirschfield. He is in town for an event tonight at the Jewish Community Center of Dallas. It's a book fair, and he will be speaking at 7. He's also the author of a book called You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. One thing that strikes me as a difference between religious pluralism and political pluralism is that, at least in religion, you have the sort of the value of mystery. Everyone can agree that there are things, or most people can agree, that there are things about faith that we can't fully understand and we can't fully explain. And there are some things that are left as divine mysteries. In politics, most people believe that there is no mystery, that this is a matter of evaluating the facts and making the right choice. So I wonder if it's actually harder to come together politically than it is in terms of sort of an ecumenical sense of how the world should work.
I think it may be, and I love that you believe that religious people are filled up with this notion of mystery. I look around the world and go, oh my God, I wish they'd have a little more sense of mystery. But in theory, of course, you are correct. Anyone who believes that they are appealing to an infinite god or goddess or gods or force, it doesn't matter. If it really is something infinite to which you appeal, then you would have to immediately admit you can never know it all and you could never possess the only way to access that infinite. Sadly, most people don't relate to their religious traditions that way, and in the name of their religious tradition are pretty absolutist.
Well, most religious traditions don't want people to relate that way, do they?
At their deepest level, I actually believe they do. And I believe within every faith, there is that impulse. And then people begin to be insecure about their faith. And in the insecurity about the possibility of their faith's vitality and ability to shape their own personal lives and contribute to a better world for all people, they give up on that unknown quality, what you're calling mystery. And I guess it has to do with what you think your faith is there to do. If you believe it's there to give you all the answers all the time and make you feel absolutely certain, I mean, that's fine, but just understand you're now no longer describing a faith, you're describing becoming God. And that's a little bit dangerous in all of our traditions. On the other hand, if you think the purpose of your faith is to fill you with the capacity and the wisdom and the love, not only to serve the members of your faith, but to actually use your faith to serve the world, then you're going to understand the role of that kind of modesty in decision-making. And it's the same thing in that sense with politics. We don't appeal to modesty and humility before an infinite that way. Here, I think it has to do with the dignity of all the people who are alongside you who don't share your views. I mean, at some level, the underlying premise of a democratic system is that you may be entirely wrong as a matter of policy, but your participation in the system is entirely necessary. And so I guess that's what we'd have to do. We don't want to appeal to some infinite God because that really would violate separation of church and state in that way. But we could ask people wherever they are on a specific issue of policy to advocate for that policy in a way that makes those who disagree with them continue to feel central to the political process.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Amir in Plano. Hi, Amir.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say you speak very eloquently, and I can't wait to read your book. My question has to do with how do we move forward from the ethnocentrism and, I guess you could call it racism, that, is a part of life in this country. Being Iranian-American, I experience it from both sides. You know, there's stereotypes that I receive from my Iranian-American friends, and there's stereotypes that I receive from my, Anglo-Saxon white friends, you know. And my question is it just education? If so, where does social responsibility for the media come into play when you have people like Fox News where they just kind of espouse the dangers of Islamics in this country and kind of put that perception up there and they push it? Is it just education or is it there's something else that we need to move on as a people? Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call.
It's a great question, Amir. I think the answer is a little bit of both. There's no question that it is a function of education, but it's also a function of the public culture we have created. And it seems to me, and frankly one of the reasons I like being on this show, is that unlike a lot of the stuff on the radio, the template is not figure out who you don't like and then spend an hour explaining to the world why they're idiots.
Apparently there's money in that, though.
Right. Yeah, it's hugely successful. It's amazing. You can be on the right and you can be on the left. And whatever you're on, you will be able to find an audience that thoroughly enjoys, almost to the point of some kind of a, orgasmic level of joy, simply listening to how other people are evil or the enemy or are idiots. And I think where the ultimate responsibility for ending that lies, because the public culture is the aggregate of all of our private cultures. And it begins with us. And it begins with the willingness for each of us to go out and find on a regular basis one or two people with whom we deeply disagree and having a cup of coffee and having a conversation. And if enough people are having those conversations, what will happen is we'll create a public culture that demands not angry rhetoric, but ongoing conversation from our media. That doesn't mean it won't have its biases. It doesn't mean people will not be filled up with very committed opinions to one side or the other. In fact, it would be terribly dangerous if we thought we could all agree and then everything will be fine. You show me a culture where people think they all agreed, and I'll show you within 5 to 10 years they were doing horrendous things. All right? Doesn't work that way. But we can create a culture in which we imagine we need to spend, say, 10% of our time with people whose ideas really make us nuts.
Yeah. Excluding family, again, as we discussed
right.
earlier.
Listen, if you can start at home, you will both heal a lot of family. It's amazing. I mean, oftentimes when I'm traveling, what will have happened just last night, in fact, in Austin, a number of people came and bought 2 copies of the book, one for themselves and one for the person they wanted to give it to. And they did it because, as I talk about when I speak about the book, this approach of you don't have to be wrong for me to be right is not something the other guy has to do. It's something we all have to do. And so the more you want someone else to learn from it, the more you have to practice it. And it's always like that. And it's like that whether it's with a book or with a conversation or with Democrats and Republicans, the idea that we really do need each other. Because I have a very simple rule. The God that I believe in, but it doesn't matter if you believe in God, it can be nature, it can be fate, that created all of us, never made any person so smart as to be 100% right or so stupid as to be 100% wrong. So it's really helpful if you're approaching that 100% issue, whether it's about politics or faith, go find one of the 1%ers and learn from their 1%.
So your book is sort of a different instrument for people who want to approach people who are different, and it does seem like a great thing to read and then pass it along to that very different person that you interact with. I wonder, though, you know, if people have enough conversations with this person on the opposite side and they realize that they can talk over coffee in a civil way, should we fight that urge that so many of us have to try and convert that person to our ideas, whether they're political or faith-based or about anything else? Or should we sort of give into it if it feels like it might be okay?
Look, I'm kind of a passionate person about the things in which I believe, so it's no problem to want to share with other people what we most believe. And you got to be pretty egoless to imagine that if someone else who you care about suddenly takes your views, you're not going to be delighted.
Right.
We're all going to be delighted. If you entertain a fantasy, though, in which everyone is supposed to share your views, you have a problem. I don't care how good the views are. So it's no problem, but don't ever confuse entering a conversation with someone which you both expect to learn with evangelizing someone so they become just like you. If you feel compelled to do that, do it. But understand, in the extreme, and you want that for everybody, you are a part of the problem, not a part of the solution, no matter how beautiful the views you espouse may be.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Bart is on the line next in Dallas. Hi, Bart.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
Great. Rabbi, thank you very much for your views. I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Thanks, Bart.
I wanted to make a couple of comments. About 2 years ago, I had the opportunity, and I went to Stutthof in Poland, outside of Gdansk. And one thing that really shocked me, as I stayed there for quite some time in the area, and I meditated in the concentration camp, and one thing that I was really surprised about was that the number of barracks that were set aside, every barracks was set aside for a different type of person, you know, homosexuals, Jews, dissidents, you name it. They were all housed differently. And there actually was a very small number of Jewish barracks there compared to the other barracks. Not to dismiss at all what happened to the Jewish people, but I think that there's a lot of people in this country that I've heard people get turned off. The Jews were persecuted. The Jews were persecuted, and it goes on and on. But there were so many other people that were also persecuted and greatly in this cleansing that Hitler initiated in the globe. And I was just interested in your comments on that primarily. So I'll take your answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Great. Thanks, Bart. Look, there's two sides to the point you raise, both of which should be acknowledged. The first is that any time a group tries to hold a monopoly on suffering, they're making a mistake. Right? When you have an epic horror like the Holocaust, to imagine that any one group owns that suffering, something is profoundly off with your story. On the other hand, the reason you found so few Jewish barracks in Stutthof is because Stutthof was a concentration camp, not a death camp. Because the other side of this is that there was no proposed final solution like there was for the Jews, for any other people, not for gays, not for gypsies, not for what they called mental defectives, not for anyone. And I think so both are true. The truth is the Holocaust was a genocidal war whose primary target, really to the point of messianic redemptive aspiration, was the Jewish people. On the other hand, millions and millions and millions of people were also murdered for the so-called crime of being gay,
of being mentally retarded, of being from the wrong country, of speaking out against the Nazis. And to imagine that we can ever forget those losses would be a tragedy.
Well, it would seem that, you know, maybe the day that we sort of fully evolve socially and how we understand this tragedy is the day that we recognize that even if all the victims had been Jews, and even if we are not Jews ourselves, it is still our loss.
Right. There's no question about that. And I hope we can get there because at some level what that involves doing. And conversely, I would hope the Jewish people would imagine that if not a single Jew had perished in the Holocaust, it would be a, quote, Jewish tragedy, because the values which Jewish people hold most dear would have been horribly violated. Right? At the end of the day, when anyone is murdered because of who they are, we are all endangered. Forget diminished. We are all endangered. And so what really has to happen is we have to begin to imagine that when we see someone else suffering, it's not someone else. It's us. That's our brother or sister or cousin or mother or father, whether they are a different color or a different faith. That for me, and again, that's what I appeal to, but there are lots of ways to get at it. What I love about that ancient biblical story that imagines an original person and his original wife. Now, I don't believe that's the way human beings evolved, but I love a story that says at the end of the day, we are one family. We all come from one original loving couple. And that means when there is a stranger 10,000 miles away suffering simply because of who they are or what they believe or the color of their skin, that's my family that's suffering, and I have to do something about it.
Is it useful to embrace the mythology that we've created for ourselves as Americans in the same way? To say this may or may not be the exact way it happened, but this is what we want to believe about ourselves, or is that a danger?
I think it depends who pays the price for the individual mythology. Mm-hmm. If the mythology we believe in is meant to shield us from greater sensitivity and awareness to the suffering of other people, I think it's a very dangerous mythology. If it's a mythology which calls us to greater purpose and to imagine that we can accomplish more than we ever imagined, and it's that story of, you know, pulling up by your own bootstraps and accomplishing amazing things for yourself and for others, I think that's great. The issue for me is not what myth do you believe. The test of any mythology or any faith that we believe in is what does the belief have in store for other people who don't share it. And so I'm in favor of any story of any people that calls upon them to do two things, both find a better, more meaningful life for themselves and empowers them to do the same for others.
Rabbi Brad Hirschfield is the author of You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism. You can find his columns at The Washington Post, on BeliefNet, and a variety of other sources. You can also meet him tonight at the Jewish Community Center of Dallas. They're holding their annual book fair. He will speak at 7, and you can find information about that at jccdallas.org or on our website. It's been so great to have you again. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. My pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.